Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoors, the official podcast of Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. We live by the motto, it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. And we live the outdoor lifestyle every day. Whether you're a landowner or dreaming of joining the ranks of those closest to the earth, we're your brothers and sisters of the outdoors. We hunt, we fish, we're stewards of the land. And our Living the Dream team will show you the way to enjoying the land and all the outdoor pursuits it has to offer. Here's your host, Bill Cooper.
Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Cooper, and I'm down in Nashville, Tennessee. It's the 50th anniversary of the National Wild Turkey Federation. And I'm set up here in the Living the Dream Outdoor Properties booth. Got a couple of guys corralled here, and we're going to talk some turkey hunting and maybe a little land management.
Yes, sir.
Whatever else they got on their mind. But I've got with me Rick Stewart. He's with the Drury Outdoors, and he's a team member.
Yes, sir.
And I understand you've been with them for a pretty good while, Rick.
20 years this year. I started filming in 2006, so it rolls over 20 years this year.
Well, over 20 years, you qualify as one of the old guys.
Anymore, I'm senior'd in now, I think. Got tenured.
Yeah.
Also with us, Justin Briel. You've heard his name many times on Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast. He's a landman, but he's also a podcaster. He bailed me out a number of times. Sometimes voice gets a week, he just has to take over and does a great job. I'm always glad to have him around.
Gift of gab.
Yeah. But, okay, what do you guys think about this grand party that's going on around us?
Rick's been coming to this a lot longer than I have, but we were just talking about that. On a Thursday morning, this is the busiest I've ever, I mean, you could tell me this was Saturday afternoon, I'd believe you.
Oh, it's wild, yeah. I mean, at least 20 years I've been coming to this in a row. The only one I missed was COVID, but I don't know that I've seen a first day or opening day this busy. This resembles a weekend.
It does.
Good for NWTF. This is great.
Yeah.
But you know, this is just the beginning.
Yeah. Calm before the storm, much calm.
Exactly. But the 50th anniversary of the National Wild Turkey Federation, now this is their 50th convention. And you know, these guys, wow. What was there, 80,000 turkey hunters here last year?
82, I believe it was.
82,000.
I think so. Yeah.
That could very easily go over 100,000 this year.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you guys think about it topping it, over under?
I'd put the over, I think it's 100,000, and I think it'll do it.
I think it will.
I think you just take the amount of years that they've been doing it and multiply it by 2,000, and that,
you know.
Well, all I can tell you guys is put your best foot forward, because you're going to have a lot of people looking at you over this 3 days.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Well, Brick, how did you manage to wind up with Drury Outdoors? It must have been a turkey killer.
You know, it did. It started with turkey hunting, turkey calling when I was in high school. Of course, whenever they first came out with their first videos, the VHS back in the day, used to rent them at the video store, you know. So we had a local video store. Then I rented the first one, Monster Bucks 1, Monster Bucks 2.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, man, these guys are killing some deer, and just became a fan. And when Dunn's, you know, was in business, we had a couple local Dunn's there in Paducah and Marion, and Mark was good friends with Dennis, and along with Mark, and came down to do a seminar, and I was still maybe high school, junior high, something like that, and I just got into turkey calling and went from there, got to meet him, went into competition turkey calling, and did some competitions, called for a little bit, placed in a lot of contests, U.S. Open and Mid-America, and got to call in, and Mark was judging, and just got to hang out, and I said, hey, I'd love to pick a camera up and keep doing it. Well, Super VHS, Panasonic AG450, it was like carrying around a suitcase, huge. And then, so I've been the transition from that to the small cam mini cassettes, now onto the SD cards and internal drives, so been going for a while, but I got really lucky. Actually, it was Miss Tracy was probably the real reason I got on there. I killed a couple deer, really good video, sent them in. They looked at them, reviewed them there in the studio, and they had them sitting on deck there. Well, I called Tracy and Mark, which I knew Tracy had messaged. I sent them in. Well, Tracy called the studio and said, hey, Brick's videos are in. Get them taken care of. They're like, who? Like, who? Well, they did it. Made the final cut, and they came down to do the voiceovers and the editing. And Terry's like, who the hey, is this guy? who was Britt?
Yeah, Britt.
Yeah, yeah, Eric. He didn't know. I was like, well, I know Mark.
Right.
There short after I got, anyway, from there on out, the hunts were great. He said, we're going to leave him on. It went on from there, and it's been best of friends with him. It wild start, lucky start, but since then, been with him ever since, and probably, I guess you'd say, I never really retire from this, but until they tell me they don't need my footage anymore, I'll continue to do it.
Absolutely, that's amazing. I love hearing these kind of stories, and I'm much older than you, but some of the things that happen to bring people into the outdoor media industry is just crazy, man. I know I've hunted with Ray I a lot over the
years.
He was the first guy that invited me to a media hunt, and he first invited me as a media hunt. What's that?
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
Had no clue.
Yeah.
But, you know, 20 years ago, would you have thought it would have developed into what it has for you?
Crazy to see it go from VHS, retail, DVDs. Now it's everything's online, digital, you know, platforms. It's wild. But to see, what it's turned into, I mean, just the show and NWTF, and it's just, wow. Crazy.
We were just talking earlier today, you know, when the probably, you know, six guys got together in a garage or a bar or something in 1973 and started NWTF. Do you think they ever would have pictured this?
No. I'm sure glad they did.
Yeah, I'm glad they did too.
Oh, me too. And it's amazing. Going way back in history, I'm not going to call any names, but there were some people who were invited to participate in organizing the NWTF, and they didn't do it because they didn't think it would fly. Yeah. I wonder what they feel like today.
Missed the boat there.
Yeah.
Well, I had a similar story coming out of college and getting ready to go into the military. I had done my graduate research work on just a keyboard. The computer was 10 blocks away, and one computer filled a room like 20 by 70 or something.
Oh, yeah.
It was incredible. Well, I was going into the military as an officer, and one of the first things they offered me was 18 months of computer school. I said, you're out of your ever-loving mind. I hate those things, and they're never going to amount to anything anyway.
You know? They had computers when you were in the military?
No kidding.
I thought that was stone tablet time still.
Well, that was just 2 weeks before.
Etched it out.
Yeah, they certainly did, you know, and they're talking about a computer fill up a huge room. Now what can you put on the head of a ballpoint pen?
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. It's mind-boggling to me. I don't understand it. I'm glad they have it. But to keep up with all this stuff, you know, that's where it's going.
Absolutely. And it's just a tremendous challenge to us, you know, Justin being, of course, he's much younger. I don't call him smarter. He's just younger, different generation.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what he's in it. But for all of us, trying to deal with the social media and how fast it seemed like as soon as I learned something, it's obsolete. Yeah. They're talking about something else.
Podcast? Who did ever thought, again, sitting around truck bed, having a few, like, let's get on here and talk about what we do.
Yeah.
And it's the fastest growing form of, I think, out there right now.
And it's
no doubt.
I mean, there's really no, I think the best ones are the ones that just kind of, it's a conversation. It feels
100%.
Like you're sitting around the fire with them.
100%.
Who does not enjoy a good turkey hunting story?
And that's what it's about.
If they don't, there's something wrong with them.
You bet. Yep. You bet.
It's just the way I look at it myself. But I scratched my head wondering where it's going to go next, you know.
Yep.
But I tell you what, coming to an event like this, it almost gives you a look into the future, because some of these companies, I'm just amazed that every year the new products that they can come up with.
Oh, you bet.
You know, how does a good thing get greater?
Yeah.
Well, there's heads out there that can figure that stuff out.
You bet.
Me, I just want to go turkey hunting.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
What I think, and you guys have probably heard this a bunch coming through the booth and being in the land business, I think one of the coolest things in the last 3 to 5 years is the number of people now, when they walk through, it's land management, habitat. What can we do to make it better to keep this resource, the wild turkey, the greatest animal on the planet, in my opinion, alive and thriving? And that's the coolest part, you know, when you talk about it now. Not so much more. It's still stories, but it's always ones that got away, or, hey, what are you doing, man? How's your flock? How's your hatch?
Exactly.
You know, and that's last night we were sitting there with Mark, Rob Keck. First thing popped up, pictures. It wasn't pictures of deer or dead turkeys. It was, hey, look at this trail cam. Look at this flock here in Nebraska. Look at my flock. You know, great hatch. Mark just said, I had 17 jakes in my backyard last night. I mean, tremendous. And that's what's cool about it is not only are you here for to celebrate the kills, but, man, it's all turned now to how can we help these creatures thrive and continue this? Because without it, NWTF wouldn't be around.
I think that along with that is, and Bill, you're in a generation that were like quail hunting. It was nothing. You guys would go out and quail hunt, right? Yep. I mean, just walk out the back door, go walk some railroad tracks, some fence rows, and you guys go kill quail. But I'm 43 years old. I've never killed one. And wow. I don't remember people hunting them.
I've killed two, three, maybe, at the most. And that was just because I was kicking up fence rows to kill rabbits, and a few came out.
Right. But what I think, it's recent enough history that people realize, like, listen, this resource can leave. You know, it's something that was abundant. It can leave. And, well, I mean, just once again, NWTF. Turkeys were basically walked off, wiped out off the face of the planet.
Yep.
They came back. They hit huge numbers. I think everybody will agree the early 2000s was the heyday.
Yeah.
And now we've seen it start trickling down. But now I think there's enough talk about habitat education and through podcasts. And that's – so just a little backstory. Brick and I are really good friends.
Years ago.
Well, I mean, for years. And you and I have been texting. You know, we text every day or, you know, shoot the bull. We're talking about where we're going to go turkey hunting. We had a mutual friend, Jeremy Hall, that got us together.
Because
we all hang out and turkey hunt and travel all over the place. And, you know, I'd say in the last probably 4 years, the conversations have turned from, you know, bucks on camera and turkeys and stuff like that to, hey, you get it? Hey, Burns done this year? Or, you know, hey, we're planning on doing this weekend, or I'm planning this or doing – it's just – and I don't know if that's something with our age, you know, as we get older and we have kids that are hunting, we're trying to give back more. It's just it's just evolved a lot.
It really has. And the coolest thing about that is, you know, all the science is developed, all the companies come along to help provide product for the science. Joe Blow out there with just a few acres, you know, can make a difference. I live out in the Ozarks. I had 10 acres and started fooling with pool. Food plots a little bit, then in the woods, you know, TSI improvement and everything. Nobody around me was doing any of that. Well, guess who was killing turkeys in their little food plots and killing bucks in those little food plots and sucking them off of other areas? They didn't bed. Bucks didn't bed on my few acres, but there were a lot of cedar thickets around me. But, boy, they loved that sweet clover and that winter wheat and that chicory and on and on and on. Okay. Then I got to messing with the soil fertility a little bit, brought it up and up and up. And
then
I'll never forget the first year I planted deer radishes. That was phenomenal what took place.
It's so much fun.
Hey, I planted that stuff, and I had read some scientific papers where they were saying it actually took a deer a couple of years to get used to a new food, and a complete two-year cycle for a doe to teach a fawn to eat certain foods. Well, the first year I planted the deer radishes, man, they popped up real quick, about 18 inches tall. It looked like iceberg lettuce.
Yeah.
You know, big around as a softball. I was so proud of myself. And a few days later, I went out there, and it looked like somebody run over it with a lawnmower. It was gone.
They find it. They'll do it.
Found it.
Yep.
And gone. And then it was like they stood there over that stuff, just waiting for the greenery to push up an inch or two. They nibble it back off. And then the roots that that stuff made, those radishes.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them a foot long. You know, as big around as a tennis ball, and they're digging that stuff out in the middle of winter.
Yep. And that's great for the soil, too, not just the deer. It's great for the soil.
It's like aerating.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you're loosening up. It's not getting compacted.
Yep.
Rick, I'm kind of curious. You know, I know you – how long have you hunted the property you own now?
I bought the property in 2016. I closed it in October of 16 is when I bought it.
But you hunted it previous to that, correct?
Yeah, I hunted it since – 2004, 2005-ish, something like that. And it was always on my mind. It was a raw farm whenever the previous landowners had it. They were patients of mine. And I just, every time I'd walk it, I'd be like, golly, if I could just get my name on this.
Uh-huh.
You know, but it's wild to look at it, though. So I closed on it in 16. My mindset has changed so much from the previous few years of plans, I want to do this, I want to do that, to now, what do I want to do with it? You know, those first few years, you always, like anything, like it's almost like a business plan. That's what I want to do, habitat. Well, my main thing was, I got to get food on here. It was like, you know, it was farmed, it was row crop, but it was picked off every year. There's nothing left. So I was like, okay, I'm going to leave this out and this out for standing grain. I got to get some clover in for year-round food. I want to get radishes. You know, I wanted to get some small plots in there, destination fields. And that was great, and it did change. It helped so much.
Right.
And I was like, okay, well, now I'm looking in the timber. I was like, well, where all my deer go? I don't have any bedding. So now I've got, you know, I planted a little bit of switchgrass and wanted to do that. I left some fields feral, just kind of burning them a little bit, you know, and now I got some regen coming up. Still, I haven't done any work to my timber yet.
Right.
That's the next plan. We'll talk about that. But,
oh, yeah.
So now I took everything out of row crop, cash crop, put it, I just enrolled it last, this past year was my first year enrolled CP2, CP2D.
I think so, yeah.
I split it up with that. I left one out as, it's a pollinator package in that field.
Yep.
So I've got food. I'm adding cover to it. In a couple of years, you'll end up probably spending some time down there because I got to do some big burns. 85 acres is what I put into it. That's in the native grasses, forbs, wildflowers. You know, it's good. It's just awesome. The first year growth I had was a better response than what I would expect them to have with the drought and everything. So,
your farm, it was really neat to see what it. I mean, just one. Well, we went down there, and Brick, I don't think you'll mind me telling this story. So I went down to help Rick to do some burns, and we burned some stuff in the morning, and, you know, it went good, and they had tried to burn a switchgrass field.
I know the story, yeah.
So, and it was the weekend before they tried to burn a switchgrass field, and as soon as they lit it, it burned a little bit and started raining. So naturally, it's not going to work out. So
it burned a good little black line, which set us up for the next one.
So we went down there that next weekend, and we're walking around. We burned some stuff, and Rick goes, he goes, "Hey, look at this switchgrass field. Tell me what you think." So we walked around a little bit, and I'm like, just the way it laid out, it could be burnt, no problem. They had already set up a black line. It was up against a creek, so it's not going to burn across that. And he goes, "Well, how do you want to do it?" I'm like, "Ah, just get out of the way." And I took off walking with a drip torch. And how big is that field?
5 acres.
5 acres, and it burnt in about 5 minutes.
Wow, that's the way to do it.
It just ripped across that field, and Brick's dad, Larry, who passed away last year, great guy, I remember he came driving around on the four-wheeler, and I looked over, and I could see Larry, his eyes looked like cue balls.
I don't know what was bigger, the flames or his face.
It's, as the flames are ripping across that field, he goes, "What are you doing?"
Is that safe?
Yeah. Oh, it'll be fine, buddy. Don't worry
about it. Well, you ain't stopping it now, but if you've never seen switchgrass burn, you need to experience it. Talk about a rush.
Hey, first burns can provide some memorable experiences. One of the first ones I burned, really just a side yard of my house, but I'd let it go. I don't know, what was it, 300-foot square or something, maybe, you know, and I'd let it grow up. I'd train my bird dogs out there. I'd cut paths through it. I'd plant birds in there, you know, and have a big old time. Well, I decided I'm going to burn this off, and, man, it was dry as long as get out, and I knew it was going to burn quickly, but... And I literally just dropped a match in the grass and the weeds and stuff there. And a wind came up immediately, man. Yep. It goes swish across. And my stepdaughter come running outside. She says, "Daddy, Daddy, a TV just went off. My TV dish was out there and I burnt the cable in two."
Normally the rule of thumb is whenever you burn something, the flame heights are going to be 2 to 3 times taller than that. So if you're just burning leaf litter, you know, that's 4 inches, you're going to be, you know, maybe a foot tall flame. At the most. Switchgrass, I mean, that's over my head. So it, you're talking something that's rolling. 6 foot tall.
Oh.
And then you get and then you burn on top of that. I mean, you got 20 foot flame heights.
And
easy.
We hit it right. No,
that's something to see, too. I was coming back from Mississippi, I think, one time, and I went through a National Wildlife Refuge, and they had it shut down. You could see the smoke for miles. I thought, man, a whole city must be burning down.
But yeah, it was tall
stuff that, boy, and a wind was behind that, and just the curls of smoke and flames and sparks that went so high. I thought, man, this is going to turn out to be a national disaster. You know? But they had it under control, knew what they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. It's a control burn. It's not a wildfire.
Yeah.
Now, and if I remember correctly, didn't one of your daughters kill a turkey out of that?
It was freshly burned. Yeah. Camille killed her first one. It walked right through the burn field, right around the blind, and...
That's awesome.
To see it, you know, full circle. Continue.
Exactly.
And actually, that field is up to burn this year.
Yeah, I was going to say, we probably need to burn that one.
Yeah, I did a little bigger fire line this time. I'm 2 bushels wide now. So
he's
learned.
He's getting smarter.
Yeah, right. I was more prepped for this one.
All righty. Well, guys, let's take a short break here, folks. Don't go away. We'll be right back for more Living the Dream Outdoor podcast. And we'll be getting more information from Vic Stewart and Justin Brill.
Our forefathers gave us a Bill of Rights. One of those is the right to step in the front door of Pond Center, where the faint sound of eagles screeching from on high a bounding purple mountain's majesty browls the walls full of glorious firearms. It's hard not to shed a patriotic tear as your red, white, and blue blood becomes fortified by the sight of true freedom. Pond Center, located 408 Highway 72 East in Rolla, Missouri. Or give us a call at 573-426-GUNS.
Hey everyone, this is Michael Collins with Misty Mountains Guiding Service. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what we offer. Misty Mountains is a smallmouth and trout-specific guiding service that caters to the Northern Ozarks region. My areas include the Upper Merrimack River, the Gasconade, and a few smaller creeks in the Mid-Missouri area. Whether you enjoy casting streamers to bass, drifting a dry fly, or ripping lips with spinning gear, I've got you covered. Fishing is made easy in my state-of-the-art drift boat raft. I control the boat with ease while you or yourself and a buddy do all the work at catching fish. Besides a great day on the water, I provide all needed gear, a delicious shore lunch, and as much fishing knowledge as you can carry with you on the way home. Spots for the 2024 season are going fast. Give me a call or text today to get your trip booked. My number is 573-823-9057. Find me on Facebook and Instagram at Misty Mountains Guiding Service. It's always an adventure with Misty Mountains.
This is Dan from the White Buffalo Fly Shop, your gateway to Missouri's blue ribbon trout streams and world-class smallmouth water. Whether you're headed to Mill Creek, the Kern, or the Gasconade, we've got the flies, the gear, and the local know-how to help you fish with confidence. If you're looking to sharpen your casting skills, join one of our hands-on clinics. Or if you'd like to craft your own fly rod, build it with us in one of our rod building courses. You're always welcome in our fly tying nights to swap stories, share patterns, and get the latest hatch reports. White Buffalo Fly Shop is more than just a place to gear up. It's a hub for our local community. You'll find us at 605 North Pine Street in Rolla or online at whitebuffaloflyshop.com.
Hi, I'm Steve Stoltz with Woodhaven Custom Calls, Mateo Camouflage, and Drury Outdoors. My turkey tip for the week this week is adjust to changes in the breeding cycle. So many hunters, you kind of get marred into the same routine. Hunt a turkey from the roost, try and get one roosted. Well, that all helps. But sometimes you have to change your tactics depending on what the breeding cycle is. For instance, early season, the woods are wide open. Turkeys aren't quite with the hens yet. They're still established and dominant. You may want to use tactics such as using a gobbler decoy in your strategy, such as using gobbler sounds to invite him over to maybe want to establish dominance with you instead of just hen sounds. The other thing you want to do early in the season, of course, is pay attention to how close you get to them on the roost. It's wide open, and you're going to have to adjust that distance between you and where you set up because it's wide open. Later on in the spring, they start getting henned up. You've got to adjust your hunting tactics to a henned up gobbler. They're not going to gobble as much. So you have to be better at getting them located and location sounds such as crow calling, owl hooting, and actually incorporating an aluminum call, which is what I do, aluminum friction call, to get them located, which is puts that higher pitch out there. And then you have later in the season where it gets heavier foliage and they're harder to hear and they're actually closer than you think they are because there's more foliage. There's all kinds of different tactics that you'll have to change your hunting tactics to become more successful as the season changes throughout the spring. That's my turkey tip for the week. I'm Steve Stoltz.
Welcome back to Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast. I hope you enjoyed that first segment. Man, we kicked some good topics around. Turkey hunting, land management, fires. What little boy doesn't like to play with fire? You know, these are big boys playing with fire, but yep. They have a purpose in mind. But got Brick Stewart here with Drury Outdoors. He's on the Drury Outdoors team, been there for about 20 years. Justin Brill, who's with Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. Both great outdoorsmen, both love the land, and they're both intensely working to manage their private land. So guys, we're going to talk about land management this time, and I know you guys got quite a history between you. Justin, I'm gonna let you lead Brick through it. Does he need led through it?
Oh no, he can
just
he
point
can,
him in the right direction.
We're just gonna point him in the right direction. It's kind of like turkey hunting. I just need a place to park.
That's right.
Yeah, Brick had kind of hinted to it earlier, you know, in the evolution of his farm and when he first started with it and how what the plan was. And I'm curious to talk a little bit more and go into a little bit more depth with that was, you know, the products, the practices, what you were doing then and how that's evolved into where it's at now.
Yeah. So, well, like you were just talking there on the break there, how you saw the farm kind of in its rough stages when I first got it. And the way I looked at it, I wanted to tackle it, was that was still in the era of food plots. Everybody just wanted food. And that was one thing I needed on there.
Yeah.
Was food. And so I got that done. You know, when we looked at it, I said, okay, I'm going to do, you kind of look at it like a checkerboard. You probably have heard that. But right. I always wanted to say, what, I want to do something different in the neighborhood. If the neighbor doesn't have it, I want it.
Right.
Because I want to be the most limited resource. Because the most limited resource is the most valuable resource.
Well, exactly.
For us in that area, food.
Right.
So I was like, I got to get food on here. Plus, you watch all the videos, people are killing everything in food plots. So I want to get them in food plots. So I got some food plots established. I cleaned out a field that first spring. That was just a nasty field, basically a thorn thicket, Russian, Russian olives,
oh, yeah.
Autumn olives,
yep,
however you want to call them. Lespediza, just got it cleaned out. I wanted to get rid of that. I was going to establish that into a destination food source. I just did a lot of work, but mainly it was just getting the areas established for food,
right.
Whether it was going to be just fall plots, annuals,
yep.
Wanted to get some perennials in there, some clovers established, and then standing grain, whatever my farmer harvested grain, how much was I going to have him leave?
Right.
In the first 2 years, you saw it, I was able to have enough food. I mean, I had, during the shed hunt,
You had so much food out there that it was, now, and you got to realize the part of Illinois that Brick's in, it's more like the Missouri Ozarks. It's not big ag country, really. It's a lot of big timber and stuff like that. So it's not like where I live up north where it's just solid ag. So when you do leave standing grains, that is a limited resource. It's got to be left in there. But there was February, March, and there were still standing beans that hadn't been touched.
Standing beans, so a lot of them.
It's actually, you had a lot of food, enough that they hadn't even touched it yet.
Yeah, I had plenty of food. And so looking at that, I was like, okay, so I'm good there as far as how many critters can I feed.
Right.
The next thing is, are they staying here?
Right.
And that's what I started looking at. You know, when you watch the videos that we do on Drury, you know, you have a history of this deer, history of that deer, and I have them for a year or two, and then it's like, okay, I don't see that deer anymore.
Right.
It's like, well, why not? You know, it's like, okay, they're not living here.
Right.
They're feeding here, and I'm getting a lot. I'm attracting late season because of that amount of food.
Right.
But they're not living there. I'm like, okay, well, I want them to live on me. I want them,
right.
I want them to have everything that they need to stay here.
Yep.
And that came down to more
right.
of cover.
More
you
cover.
You know, I wanted more cover.
Yep.
And so I did a few small things up front. I took one of the fields that I'd left out for destination food.
Yep.
Put it in switchgrass, which is a monoculture of switchgrass that I'm, this year when I burn it, I will likely change that up a little bit.
Go I'm gonna and spray run a little bit.
Yeah, I'm going to run a disc through it, do yep. some spraying to try to break that up. I've got some seed that I'm going to kind of intersperse on it if I can catch it right. Try to break that up a little bit, but it's not super thick to where they're not using it. It's not that wall
right.
that sometimes switchgrass turns into if you get it. I mean, you'll hear lots of you can't get it too thick, and I agree to a certain extent, but what I'm looking at is I want more of a diversity out of it.
Yeah.
You know, I have nothing wrong with maybe putting a monoculture switch in.
Right.
A lot of people do it, and I've done it, and it's not bad. I just don't want it to get bad.
Well,
so I'm going to take precautionary to get in there and do that.
From a hunting standpoint, too, like what you're talking about, you had the food. You were drawing them in.
Yeah.
So I imagine you probably had lots of nighttime pictures.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So they're
yeah.
hitting that destination food at night, which is normal. But what, you know, from a hunting strategy to think of, and you don't know, like those deer that you're talking about, we had a history. I saw them for a year, then they disappeared. Well, if they're living, when I say living, I mean somewhere that where there's cover, where they feel safe or whatever, if that's two farms over, your neighbor may have killed him, but he was
Correct.
Going to your
yeah.
place.
Yeah.
So if you can create that structure to where they're going to live on your farm, eat on your farm, and, you know,
all-inclusive.
All-inclusive. They're going to – they're never – their whole core area isn't going to be on, you know, a 100-acre or
right.
300-acre
yeah.
piece. But if you can make it to where the majority of the time spent there, you have the best opportunity to kill them.
Percentage of daylight,
but
you
daylight
want them
activity.
Living on you. I mean,
yep.
you're never going – on 300 acres, I'm not going to hold them forever
right.
all day. But if I can catch a majority –
Yep.
The highest percentage of their time in daylight there, our odds go up. Our percentage goes up. We'd be able to see that deer and kill that deer,
Absolutely.
Harvest that deer. So,
well, I got a question for you guys. You're obviously both good land managers. You got some experience behind you, and you've had some failures, I'm sure. You've
oh, yeah.
had some successes. But have you translated all this information and experience in your head to the point that you can plan out your year so that you can hold those animals, deer or turkeys, on your place when you need them there. And when's that? During the season.
During the season.
Have you got that planning process worked out that well?
It's an ever-evolving plan, I feel like. My farm is something, it's still a work, and all these product pieces are works in progress. So, but I'm still kind of figuring mine out as far as, I've had some good deer that have showed up there, and, you know, I've shown you pictures of deer that are living, that are hanging out on my farm, getting daylight pictures.
And for your area, those are exceptional deer.
Yeah, they're really,
you won't see him on a social media. He's not going to share those deer. You don't want to do that.
No,
neighbors might.
Well, he hadn't even shared with me. Of course, I only live about an hour from his farm.
Exactly. Again, you won't see those pictures.
Yeah. Those keep a little closer to the vest. But no, it's so, you know, I started getting pictures of better deer, more deer on my property, and then I started noticing in the rut, they're vanishing. Well, okay, so is it, and I'm trying to figure that out, why is it? Now, I only have 120 acres, so I'm not going to be keeping them for a long time. Are they searching out different doe groups? Do I have too many does on my property that's causing pressure on those deer and they're wanting to leave? You know, that's part of the equation of figuring that out.
Right.
And when you're doing, part of the, like, the management styles that Brick and I are doing now, it's not an every year you do the exact same thing. It's like these burn rotations we do are usually 2 to 5 years, depending on what you're burning and if you can burn it.
Right.
That's when that plant community and that structure changes through that point. So what's food right now, it'll be bedding in 2 years, and then, you know, they might use that as bedding in a couple of years, and then you burn that. Well, now it's restart, and now we're back to food.
First
again.
Season so, successional, yeah, second season successional.
Things are rotating. Well, it's the same way with the turkeys. You burn it, you know, that's kind of, you'll start creating some brood rearing habitat. After about 2 years, that same piece of ground is more built for nesting than brood rearing because they're starting to get a little bit thicker. So it's a constant. You kind of got to adapt on the fly as you're doing this style of management.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when you're talking about burning, I think people often get the concept in their head, well, you're burning your whole place every year.
No.
Nope.
Okay. Talk about that just a little bit, how you manage that.
Yeah. So, like you said, if you burn the whole thing again, it'd be like, come back to like that switchgrass. You'd have a monoculture.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You don't want the same thing over. So, for example, my farm now, I took the cash rent. I put it into the CRP program, and it is broken up. Every field is broken up into three parts. And so every year, a third of that field would be burned. Well, I've got, I think, seven fields. So a third of each of those fields would be burnt every third year.
Right.
So this will, say the north half be burnt in 3 years from now. The middle half be burnt in 4 years. It only been 5 years. So it just goes in that rotation. So you always have a different season of growth in different areas, but will always have a different set in it.
Right. So that goes along with what you were talking about before, is as all inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
So when you burn in those stages like that, you have food, cover, you know, in different stages of growth all through there. And all these animals that we hunt are edge animals, right? They love edges. They love fence rows. They love all that because they like being close to cover. But so the more edge, you can create edge doing that practice by having the different stages of burns.
Yep. Absolutely. And it depends what your goals are with that.
Yep.
You know, with the CRP, you know, it's grass, but if you get into the timber, mm-hmm. Are you looking to set back some of the the hardwood structures?
Right.
Are you wanting, you know, it depends on what your goals are with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know,
my farm, I mean, it was, and you haven't, and we're still working on trying to get Brick out there to see
so
the work that we've been doing, but it's, my farm was primarily, it's an oak hickory dominated forest that were full of oak trees that were maybe 8 to 10 inches around. Well, I had too many of them. I'm cutting trees down.
Yeah.
And get, you know, and some people are planting, they're like, do you need trees to plant? No, I'm good.
Asked you that earlier, NWTF did a pilot program where the state nursery was mm-hmm. giving out so many trees and shrubs for members,
right.
NWTF members.
Yep.
I've got a few because I've got some that I'm going to fill in some spots. But he's like, no, I'm the opposite. I'm trying to thin them.
Yeah. I looked at that thing. I'm like, we'll take some shrubs, you know, and do that in some of my open areas. And I got a hold of Chase, and I was like, hey, man, you know, that program, he's like, sold out in 5 hours. I'm like, oh, okay, never mind.
I got some. My order went through. I'll give you some.
Okay.
Well, guys, I'm a big fan of natural foods that are already there.
Yeah.
When you're talking about your burning, you're planting your food plots, do you think about the wild plants that are already there with sumac, blackberries.
Oh, 100%. That's the main reason.
That's the whole reason we do it.
Whatever. Yeah.
So one of the neat – oh, I'm sorry, and I'm going to go back to your farm, but a neat thing, I remember that first year I went out there, and we talked about it before, where you still had standing beans. So those
I forgot to mention persimmons.
Oh, my favorite.
Well, those beans never got harvested. You were going to start letting it go wild and then start on these CRP programs and all this different stuff. So it didn't get planted, if I remember correctly. And a lot of those beans just dropped and then resprouted, and you had beans again the following year. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And how and in with all
volunteer.
Those beans, remember when I went out there, I'm like, I cannot believe the amount of ragweed.
Oh, yeah.
It was just ragweed through there. And it's deer love that. And it's
allergens nightmare, but a deer love it.
Deer, it's very high in protein. Quail love it because of the egg. I mean, just there's a ton that goes along with it. And that was a cool thing that saw that came back. I mean, within a year, it just don't touch it. The seed bank's there. It'll happen.
Yep. It came
absolutely
up.
One of the favorite things I look for, the old timers used to call it corn cresses. It's just looked almost like a little head of lettuce coming up, and deer will. Hey, they'll munch on
that
stuff.
They'll wear that out.
Anything that you can help, and sometimes they'll go to those natural plants because in their makeup, they know that there's a particular mineral or something in that plant that they need.
That they need.
So, hey, man, and it's a complex world out there.
It is.
And I always like to say that deer hunters and turkey hunters are some of our best land managers and conservationists because they study and they figure this stuff out.
Amen.
Yep. Now, on top of that, we've got a lot of state and federal agencies that will help you with this process. You guys use any of those agencies in your
Absolutely.
Yeah,
funds?
Like I said, with my CRP, you know, it's it was the programs I put it in, Native Grasses and Forbs, which we were talking about. And then part of that program is I had to reintroduce trees and shrubs. We planted 30, my daughter's, bless her heart, they got a good, I gave them a trip out of it. We planted 3,800 trees by hand.
And how
many? 3,800. Oh. Yeah, and with a dibble bar and sweat equity.
Oh,
and
my God. So, I'm glad you didn't call me for those trips.
Yeah, so
that's
my daughter, at the time, 10, well, they're still, so at the time they were 12 and 9.
Yep.
And, we planted maybe 500 of those with a tree planter in some rows. But rest of them were in circles. We had to do 45-foot circles and plant 46 trees within that circle for the proper spacing. So introducing, like you're talking about, the shrubs. Some of those shrubs and trees were persimmon trees, sumac, fragrant sumac, silky dogwood, hazelnut, Chickasaw plum, American plum. Golly, this plethora of those plants that you're talking about, this native
diversity.
Food. Yeah, diversity, native food. So, but I was going to key on a minute ago. You're talking about, do we think about when we burn, do you think about those plants coming back? Absolutely, and that's when it comes down to, again, you talk about fire, the timing of that fire, whether you're going to burn a dormant season burn like this time of year or you're going to do a growing season burn, because that growing season burn is going to likely give you more of your forbs.
Yep.
Than your grasses, your wild grasses that you want, your native grasses. So you got to think about that. But yeah, again, that's something you can plan out. This year I'll burn it, you know, do say two growing burns, and then the next one hold off, and then do a dormant season burn. So you get, again, you know, your diversity in your plants. Yeah, you change the structure, and you get a little bit of all of it. So you do, you know, you do need to think about that and plan it. Yeah. But all, again, it comes down to your goals. Are you wanting to burn it for the grasses and just bedding, or are you wanting to do it for the food?
Yeah.
It's best of both worlds if you do them together.
It is. And it's there's a lot of different things you can do with that. Well, I mean, like I said, Rick and I talk quite a bit. I was sending him pictures of I burnt the same 7 acres twice this year. I burnt it originally in probably September and was trying to just burn the edge. And then it didn't. I mean, it burnt good around the edge, but once it got to the interior, it didn't really burn. And then I came back about a month ago and burnt the rest of it off. So I'm curious to see how that's going to affect it. What I'm trying to achieve is on the edges, if that killed off a lot of that woody structure and get more forbs there, and then on the center would be more grasses and stuff like that. I think that'd be kind of a neat
mosaic
effect,
little thing there.
Effect there.
Kind of neat.
You know, Brick and I, we've hinted on it. You know, we were talking about his girls planting the tree, being out there and planting the trees. And I know Brick's obviously, you know, it's we're both at an age, our kids are the same age. Actually, so Brick and I are taking our kids, and our friend Jeremy is taking his son out. We're all going to South Dakota and taking the kids out there turkey hunting this year.
Wow, so, that sounds like a great plan.
So. Yeah, we like to get our kids involved, and our kids are friends and stuff like that. And one of my favorite things was when we were out there doing all those burns was it was you and the girls, and I had Jace out there running around. And, you know, Jeremy had Braden, you know, all the kids are out running around. And I think they're learning. It's not, you know, my boys are out asking questions, or my boy is out asking questions saying, you know, hey, Dad, well, why are we doing this and how are we going to do this?
Yeah.
And it's something not everybody knows how to do. And it's just another way to get them in the outdoors and appreciate what we're doing.
Get
absolutely.
Back.
Well, looking into the future just a little bit, you're gonna laugh, Brick. But in the last about 3 years, I've been working with some Missouri Baptist homes. Our organization has got six. We don't call them nursing homes. They're a place to come live. And they call the residents neighbors.
Yeah.
It's a pretty cool deal. But
that is a good deal.
All six of these facilities have land with them. We've started a deer and turkey hunting program, and they're managing these lands. Can you imagine how cool it is to get people out of a nursing home facility out into the outdoors, and they watch the burns. You know, they can't really participate.
But can you imagine what that does for their mental health? Just to get out of that, to get out in nature.
Some of them hunted all their life, and all of a sudden they don't get the opportunity anymore. Right. Oldest hunter was 94 years old.
God bless him. That is fantastic.
You can imagine that. And this guy had been an NRA instructor, and we were this particular time we were hunting with crossbows, and Mr. Fred shot his crossbow three times at 20 yards. And all the bolts were touching.
Yeah.
94 years old.
God, what an inspiration.
I hope to goodness I can do that. Now,
I imagine.
Now, well, Fred, hold on.
I'll make it 94.
I'm doing some math here. 94, I'm 43. Hell, that means I still got 51 years left.
Yeah. I hope you make it, brother. But Mr. Fred was pretty, you could tell he was outdoorsman because he was pretty quick to gouge you. The last morning we were having a breakfast out under a gazebo, and I need to leave, so I'm walking off in front of everybody. Mr. Fred yells, "Hey, Mr. Bill," I said, "what do you want, Fred?" He said, "if you ever need any help with your shooting, just call me."
That is awesome.
Isn't that awesome?
Oh, yeah, he's a hunter for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, but we had a lady this year who's on dialysis, had been in a hunting family all her life, but never got to go hunting.
Yep.
And, man, we had some guys come in. We had some trees that needed to come down, and a guy out of Viburnum was close to the Arcadia facility. He come over and got those trees down, took him to his personal sawmill and come back. Now we got six new big slab
benches.
Deer blinds.
Deer blinds. Not deer even better.
Blinds,
even better.
And this lady that was on dialysis killed her first deer ever, which was a pretty decent little buck, you know. And she probably won't be with us next year.
No kidding.
Yep.
Well, but hey, I mean,
isn't that incredible?
That is awesome.
What I take from that is, one, you're never too old.
Exactly.
There
now,
you
where
go.
I was mm-hmm. going with this, I'm recruiting. You guys look like two good candidates for the nursing facilities.
Yeah.
I said, here we go.
To live in or to help with?
we got guys.
If you got hunting there, but I might take you up on that.
Yeah, I mean, if any of these. Do any of these gals in the home, like, still own property?
Well, I haven't investigated that far. I figured you'd go in trying to sell property.
If they still got some, those nursing homes are expensive, especially if they offer guided hunts. So, you got to fund that somehow.
Yeah. But this has been an incredible program that we've
put
together with the National Deer Association.
That's cool.
And they've just, it's just been phenomenal. Media's gone nuts on this. Back
as they should.
Sent a videographer in. And did some film.
That is a great program.
It's neat.
So you guys have still got a few decades left in you, I think. So.
Well, hope so.
What I think is really neat about that program is there's always, and I'm not taking away from it because this is, you know, there's always stuff for kids, which is great. And it's, you know, kids are the next generation of it. If we want to keep this going, we got to keep the kids involved. And then, you know, different groups, veterans are always one, you know, that's redone. But I never thought about I'll say the elderly. I don't know if that's right to say or not, but we'll go with the folks that are maybe a little longer in the tooth.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm starting to think a little more about it.
Yeah. And you know, think about it, those are the ones that pioneered a lot of this for us, possibly, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that set it up for us to have these. exactly. these critters or this property that you guys sell and that we love so much to get yeah. our hands dirty on. Exactly. They're the ones that had it, you know, and took care of it. I don't care how old you are. You know, if you have land, you've loved land.
There's definitely, being an owner of it, it definitely changes your perspective on it.
Absolutely.
It really does.
Were they able to eat any of that wild game? Eat the venison?
Yeah. As a part of the program, we always serve them
wild game dinner.
Hey, smash burgers and all that kind of thing. Yeah. The same lady that killed the buck the previous year, she had hunted, didn't have any luck, but we had it was funny. I was sitting up on a hill back at the home watching across this valley, and she was in a blind across the valley. There was this group of turkeys that kept feeding up and down through the field, and turkey season was open at the time, the fall turkey season, while she was bow hunting with her crossbow. And I kept thinking, well, surely they'll take a shot at those turkeys. They kept working close to the Miss Judy put an arrow right through a turkey's tail feathers. But she went out and picked up every last feather she knocked.
You bet, yeah.
She went to every room in that nursing home to share with everybody else.
That's neat.
And we called her Turkey Tail Judy. She got her name out of it.
That's great. That's a neat program right there.
But you never know what something about the outdoors and land management can lead to. But we've laughed and joked. But I've listened to you guys here now for 30 or 40 minutes, and I can tell it's easy to see that you – the passion that you have for what you're doing. And man, I applaud you for that. And you're living a great lifestyle. And we are very fortunate people. And here we are sitting in the middle of 80,000, maybe more hunters coming in this week.
Likely more.
Yep. Yeah.
All right.
If I can just get them to buy some dirt now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Hey, it won't be hard. There we go out there and get your hands on it.
No, for anybody listening, I got free samples and bags of topsoil sitting here. You know, you try them out, see if you like it. And then...
Oh, guys, you never end it. All right. We're going to wind it down here. Folks, we appreciate you listening. Rick, appreciate you being on the program.
Hey,
hope you won't be a stranger now.
I'll talk about dirt and farms.
We work for the same company.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, DeerCast. Check it out.
Justin, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, sir.
And folks, from the three of us, Rick Stewart, Justin Brewer, myself, Bill Cooper, we're living our outdoor dreams. We encourage you to get into the outdoors and live your dreams as well.
People love a good mustache. People also love a good firearm. The fine people down at Pond Center like both. They have the largest selections of firearms in the area, and with a friendly, knowledgeable staff of hombres to help you pick the gun that's right for you. You could end up riding into the sunset with a gun you love. Find them at pc72guns.com, on shelf, in store, online, or give them a call at 573-426-GUNS. That's Pond Center. Guns welcome. Mustache appreciated.
Captain Brian Wilson runs one of the tightest bow fishing operations in the business. Stainwater Bow Fishing operates out of Jerome, Missouri, and the beautiful Missouri Ozarks. They cover most Ozark streams and lakes. You haven't lived until you've searched Ozark waters during the night with Stainwater Bow Fishing while looking for giant gar, carp, and buffalo. Captain Wilson also runs a second boat on Taneycomo Lake. Call today to book a trip with Stainwater Bow Fishing at 573-263-8016. Again, that's 573-263-8016. Be sure and shoot straight.
The Living the Dream Outdoors podcast is brought to you by Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, The Fly Rod Journals, SmokerBuilder.com, Cowtown USA, Westover Farms, Scenic Rivers Taxidermy, Stained Water Bow Fishing, Scenic Rivers Guide Service and Tours, Huzzah Valley Resort, Devil's Backbone Outfitters, J&J Charters, Kaufman Cove, Alaska, Bean Creek Game Calls, Misty Mountain Guide Service, ASO Guides and Outfitters with Ryan Walker, The Rambling Angler, and Rich's Famous Burgers.
Land ownership is the American dream. Land is the basis of all life. Our wise use of this most precious of resources ensures the survival and growth of free institutions and our American way of life. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we value the traditions and freedoms that land provides us. Every day we seek the solace of a mountain sunrise over traffic jams and smog, the calming silence of a bubbling stream over the sirens of the city, and the quiet of the countryside over the hustle and bustle of the world. We hunt, we fish, we farm. We live off the land. It's our mission to help our clients live out their dreams on the land as we do. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we believe that it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. Join us 5 days a week on Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast as the Living the Dream Outdoor Dream Team explores the most desired outdoor properties in the Midwest and whisks you away to incredible hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation opportunities. Host Bill Cooper, an inductee of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, will be joined by members of the Living the Dream Outdoors team each week as they tell tall tales, unveil tips and tactics, and rub elbows with some of the biggest names in the outdoor world. You'll also find the Living the Dream Outdoors podcast on your favorite social media platforms, including Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok.